Okay, guys, welcome. Reish Yerushalayim, Thursday night Parsha, Rosh Chodesh Adar. Here we go. So the Parsha starts off with Bnei Yisrael being commanded by the Berim Hashem El Moshe Leimor, that Rel Bnei Yisrael Veikuli Truma. You shall take from me Truma. Obviously, we know what it's talking about, collecting for the Mishkan. Good, you guys got it. And what's interesting is that, and I'll just tell you, we're not going to do this from Ramban aside like we do, you know, on Wednesday nights, but the Ramban comments right at the beginning of the Parsha. He says, why is it that the Mishkan appears here of all places in the Torah? Like, what suddenly happened now that they got the Mishkan at this place, at this point? So he points out that right after we received the Torah, right after we received the Seres Adibros, there's a few key psukim in Parshas Yisro, right before we received the Torah, that maybe was a condition for Hashem wanting to dwell among us, as one of the key psukim in this week's parsha is, "Asuli mikdash v'shachanti b'socham," which means, "Make for me a holy abode, and I shall dwell among you." One of those famous pasuk. So he points out, the Ramban points out, that in Yisro it says, "V'atem ti yulim l'machas ko'anim v'goy kadosh," and you shall be for me a nation of priests and a holy nation. Meaning, now that you are an elevated status above all the other nations of the world, and now that you are considered my children, my nation, and you have received the Torah, and you're supposed to uphold the Torah, you have therefore have an elevated holy status, and now, only at this point, Hashem decides, build me a Mishkan and I can dwell among you. Meaning Hashem can only dwell among us when we're of a certain elevated, holier status, a separated status. So that's what the Ramban points out right at the beginning of the Parsha. Why is it that the Mishkan appears here of all places in the Torah? Now, I'd like to first go into the first Keli, the first vessel that is described at the beginning of the Parsha. Does anyone know what that is? Good! You got it! The Aron. And what's unique about the Aron, I'll read you a few psukim regarding the rest of the Kelim in the Beis HaMikdash. I'm sorry, in the Mishkan. And it says, V'yasisa bade asei shitim. And it says, V'yasisa kaporis zahav tahor. V'yasisa shulchan ete shitim, V'yasisa lo misgeres, V'yasisa lo arba tabaos, V'yasisa es abadim, V'yasisa karosav, V'yasisa menorav, V'yasisa es nerosav, V'yasisa eser irios, Asisa lulaos, so on and so forth. He keeps using the word asita, 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 which means what?
You
will make, you shall do. Correct. Meaning you in the
past. It's in the past. Asita is past.
Future.
You made.
Well, who is it? You plural or you singular?
Plural.
So then it should be asita.
Asita is singular.
Singular, correct.
Yeah.
It's not a C10.
It's
a C-ta. Right, so singular. And most probably it's talking to Moshe or we know who. Do we know who built the Mishkan?
Salah.
Shout out. Is it Tevet Salah then? Is Dal a is Tevet Salah then?
No, today is
Mitzalah. Ooh, yeah!
Today is Mitzalah.
For all those Salahs.
So I mentioned the Parsha piece.
And you're going to wear it on Shabbos also, because tomorrow's Friday.
Yeah.
Nice. And you got to wear it next week, because that's the Tzav, and then you got to wear it again in 3 weeks. Okay, good. So that's all of the Kelim, the menorah, the shulchan, all the badim, all everything, the whole, the walls. It also says asisa, asisa, asisa. You shall make, you shall make, you shall make. However, when we look at the Aaron, very interestingly, it says viasu Aaron atzei shitim. Viasu. What's viasu? It's you shall make, but you is lashon plural. You meaning collectively, not just singular.
Isn't you shall make future? And asu is not future. Asu is in the past.
That is true. We generally say asu.
Would be naseh
or asinu. It would be naseh would be more proper future tense. But I believe in this biblical Hebrew, v'asisa, it's
future.
You shall make. Yeah, because clearly it's not being built yet. This is the command to do it. But the question is, what is unique about the Aron, number one, that all of a sudden, this is the only one, the only Keli in the Mishkan, that suddenly the language changes from singular to plural? That's question number one. And the second thing is, we know that as they transported all the Kelim, how would they carry it?
With the beams.
With the beams. They stuck beams through the holes. They're called badim, these poles, and they carried it all these on the shoulder, and that's how they transported from place to place. And but when they settled, wherever they settled, they rebuilt the Mishkan, they removed the poles because they didn't need them, because they didn't need them until they're traveling. However, the Torah tells us, V'yasisa badei atzei shitim b'tzibisa osam zahav, V'hevisa es abadim ala tzalos aron l'seses aron bahem. And you shall place the badim into the rings on the sides of the aron, in order so you shall carry them. And then it says, "B'tabaos ha'aron yehiyu ha'badim lo yasrim imenu." And when you place them in, you shall not remove them. And Rashi points out one word, li'ola, forever. You'll never remove them. Meaning, even when you're settled, even when you stop traveling, you've rebuilt it, they stay inside. So the question is, what's unique about the aron? The badim have to stay inside. That's question number two. Question number three I'd like to propose is, why was there even a need to carry the aron? Meaning, it's such a heavy burden.
Yeah,
when I put on a wagon, have some animals draw it.
Oh, well, is that very
true? Yeah, you can say the same thing. Okay, put them on wagons, let them go.
It means more special than it could be.
More special, how so?
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's so.
Good, say better, yeah.
If you carry something yourself, like your baby, for example, when you put it in the carriage, like you're like pushing it, but when you're holding your hand, you feel like a connection to it.
There's certainly some truth to that. Very good. Very good. Yeah, what do you want to say, Ethan?
Yeah, I was going to say that if you were to give it to an animal, yes, it would accomplish the goal of transporting it, but you wouldn't feel any sort of personal attachment. Like when you're holding it and you're putting the effort into holding something, you often contemplate putting it down, but then you realize what you're holding.
Okay, good.
When you come to the realization of why you're holding it, you develop their connection with it.
Okay, so clearly there's a stronger connection when you're actually machzik, when you're actually holding the object. Okay, that's very good. Yeah.
Also, one of the reasons why God gave us the Mishkan was so that the Jews had some sort of idol similar to like the non-Jews also had. So maybe this was like a way for them to like kind of feel they're actually doing something like related to worship, not just transportation.
Well, that would be applicable when they're actually doing the service, no?
But I'm saying, like, you wouldn't put an idol on that, like, on a wagon carrying an animal. You wouldn't put, just like you wouldn't.
I mean, what you're trying to say is it shows an elevated status to the object.
Elevated status, yeah.
Okay, you're also good. The question is, though, what is it that we're supposed to feel a connection to? To these, like, it's a kelim. It's a nice piece of gold, basically.
The kelim is a conduit to what they give to God.
It's the gold that we took out from Mitzrayim that like we worked like over 210 years, and like we went through so many hardships with that gold, and that gold represents like Yetzias Mitzrayim and stuff like that. So that's the connection they had to it.
Very interesting idea. But the gold, we actually didn't work for. We just asked the mystery before we left. We said,
yeah, but over 210 years when we were slaves in Mitzrayim, they deserved the gold, and like that gold like reminds them, like, oh, you see, Mitzrayim. Like,
it's like a compensation.
Yeah, exactly.
Very interesting idea. Yeah.
Well, you could say that, like, the thing about these objects is that we're not worshiping the objects themselves, right? The objects are a conduit to what God is, right? There's a mafarish that says the chesed eagle, chesed eagle. Originally, the goal of the chesed eagle was for them to replace Moshe. They wanted a conduit to God, so they were going to worship. Then it evolved into actually worshiping the eagle itself. So same thing. So I guess you could say, like, obviously the menorah and the kelim were the eagle, and because God commanded to do it. But you want to develop a relationship with these kelim, because in turn you're developing a relationship with God, because that in essence represents God, physical manifestation of God, because it was God's will to create it. So therefore,
okay. No, you're both saying very good. One thing I'm going to tweak is that there is something very unique and specific that the Aaron represents. The Aaron of the compared to the other kelim.
Law, mitzvah.
Even better than that.
Is mitzvah
better than that? Let's just make a sequence of three questions and then we'll come back. Because I think with this one you sowed, if we understand what the Aaron's all about, we can come back and come through all our answers, all our questions. The first question was, what's the difference between Ta'aseh, Asita, 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 you, singular, and also the Aaron is Asu, plural. That was question number one. Question number two we asked was, why did the Badim, the poles, and the Aaron of all the other Kalim has to be there forever, even when you're not traveling? Seems very strange. And number three, why can't we just put it on a wagon? Why do we have to seemingly carry it from place to place? So to answer these questions, let's show the idea. What does the Aron really represent? And the answer is the Aron really has a dual purpose. The Aron itself is one of the Keli HaMikdash. It's one of the foremost vessels that was used in both the Mishkan and then the subsequent Beis HaMikdash. However, there's another unique idea behind what the Aron represents. And that is, you guys also good, Mikdash, law, it's the Torah. The Torah itself. Why? Tell me why.
The Torah is derived from it. That is the Torah, that's the foundation of the Torah.
Better. The Torah is actually in the Aron. The Aron is the vessel which holds the Shnei Luchos Sabris. That's where Moshe not only put the Aron, the two tablets, he also put all the broken pieces of tablets. So the Aron, which carries the Torah itself, the Luchos, the law, that's what it represents. That's what the Aron represents. And if we can understand that the Aron is supposed to represent Torah, I think we can come back to all our questions. So the first question is, why does it say Asita? Why does it say Asu, not Asita? Well, very simply, and the Ramban actually says this on the spot. He says because the Torah wanted to emphasize that the Aron is not something just that Moshe or just Bezalel is supposed to build. Every single Jew has a portion in the Torah itself. Every single Jew, whether they're going to give to it specifically, or whether they have some sort of intent, the Ramban says, that they could somehow join with Bezalel and Moshe to build it. But the point is to show that the Torah is not something unique to just the Talmid Chachamim. It's not something unique to those people who are interested. Every single Jew, whether they're big, small, whether they're learned, whether they're just beginner, they always have a portion in Torah. And I think that's such an important idea. I think that's such an important idea because, well, actually, I think what's very unique about our religion, Judaism, is that if you look at something like Christianity, so Christianity says that the study of the Bible, the study of the law, is really just for the noblemen, for the clergy, right? All the mundane, all the regular folk, all the other people, they don't really have to study, they don't have to know the law. Judaism says not that way. Torah is not something for the rabbis. It's not. The Torah is something that every single Jew has an obligation to learn, an obligation to know. Whether you're end up being a dentist or a lawyer or a businessman, whatever it is, you have an obligation to know Kol HaTorah Kula. From Chumash to Mishnah to Gemara to Halacha, everyone has an obligation to know. Right? That's why I don't really care for the title rabbi. It doesn't make a difference to me. As a Jew, I know that I'm obligated. I'm supposed to be part and parcel of the Torah, no matter what I do or whatever, no matter where I am. That's why the Torah emphasizes Asu es Aaron, because the Torah is something which connects everybody. Torah is something which has a portion for everyone to share it. And if we understand that the Aaron represents Torah, we understand why the Badim have to always be in the holes. Because the Torah always has to be something ready on the go. It always has to be something when you're on the move. You have to take it and go with you. No matter where you're going, physically, spiritually, mentally, you always have to be on the go. That's why the Badim have to always be there. And not only that, but the Badim, they represent the ability to carry, they represent to hold it. And there always has to be supporters, there always has to be people who delve and give the proper time in order to really understand the Torah. That's what the Badim represent forever. Rashi, remember again, it's the Olam. They always are there, whether they're traveling or not, to show that Torah always has to be supported. Torah always has to be ready to go. And finally, you know, you guys also good about this question. Why not put on a wagon? Because the Torah is something that you can never lose, have hesach hadas from. Never be distracted from. Right? It's very interesting. Tosis and Brachos asks, he says, why is it that when you go into your sukkah on the Chol Moed Sukkos and you decide I'm going to have a bagel, lox, and cream cheese? So you sit down, you wash the moed, and you say, Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech HaShem Tzivanu L'Shev Basukkah. And then you go to work, you come back for lunch on a lunch break, and you want to have a piece of pizza. So you say, you wash, and you say, Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech HaShem Tzivanu L'Shev Basukkah. And then you go do your errands, you come back at night, you want to have a burger on a bun. And you say again, Leshei Basukkah. Every time you want to have a suit on the sukkah, you say Nusha Leshei Basukkah. However, as Tosfos, what is the difference between sukkah and Birchas HaTorah? Because Birchas HaTorah, we know, how many times a day do we say Birchas HaTorah? once. But if after learning morning Seder, you go and take a 3-hour nap, and you come back to the base for afternoon Seder, do you go ahead and you say a new Berachas Torah before you start learning? Why not, Estosos? What's the difference between Sukkah and Berachas Torah? Every time I want to have a meal in the Sukkah, new Leshei B'Sukkah. But if I go to work, after I have my pre-Shacharis Chavrusa, and then I come back at night, and after dealing with my kids and doing my, you know, whatever I need to do, I sit down and learn before I go to sleep, I don't say a new Berachas Torah. So what's the difference? As Tosus, what's the difference between Sukkah and Torah? And Tosus says an unbelievable answer. And he says, because Torah, a Jew never really leaves their mind. They're always, and you see, if someone lives by Al Pi Halacha, then even when they're at work, even when they're at their job, even when they're doing whatever they're doing it according to Halacha, then it means that they really never have a distraction from Torah. And that's why you can't just put the iron in a wagon and have animals carry it. Because since it represents Torah, because the Torah is what it held, we therefore see that you have to hold it, you have to show that you're never going to be distracted, you're never going to ever, you know, your mind ever be off or taken away from Torah in totality. And that's the reason why, and that's now we come back and answer all our questions over here. And, okay, that's the first idea. The second idea I'd like to share with you tonight is we go back to the beginning of the Parsha. So there's a very strange word, and Rav Bradfeld's father-in-law made mention of this, at the bris today, but it's a very strange word when it says "vayiku li truma," which means "take for me truma." What should it say? Should give to me, right? You're not taking for Hashem; you're giving to Hashem. You're giving so that they can build a mishkan for me. So, what's the deal with this word "vayiku"? So, after he asked the question, I was looking around today, and there's a machlokas in the Meforshim between Rashi, Ibn Ezra, and the Sforno. Now, what does it mean, Vayikhu Lishma? Lishmi. Very good, Johnny. That's what Rashi says, right? And what does that mean, Lishmi?
For my name.
For my name. Or for my sake. Yeah. Right? Meaning
that you're benefiting by giving.
Whoa. Slow down. Slow down. No, that's actually not. Rashi's saying, he's pointing out, is that you can't physically take for Hashem. Or you can't make for Hashem. It's impossible. So what it means is you're taking really for yourself, but you're doing it only because Hashem commanded to, meaning lishmi, for my sake. That's Rashi's interpretation. Ibn Ezra says, no, that's not what it means. Ibn Ezra explains like this. He says, whenever you have a phraseology of lakach, le, meaning the word lakach, and then followed by a le, so in this case it would be like vayichu li, or lakach, le, whatever, lakach lo, he points out Tanakh, it always refers to a type of giving, to a type of nesina. Why? Because if it was take from something, then you would say lakach min, right? Take from in order to give. But lakach le, take to, it doesn't really make so much sense. Take to, you don't take to something, you take from something. So taking to something really is an idea of giving, because you're giving towards. You're taking from yourself to give. So that's what Ibn Ezra says. And finally, this Sforno, he says a very interesting thing. It says, Bnei Yisrael wasn't commanded by Yichu li Truma. It says, when Hashem or Moshe said, take for me a Truma, a gift, it was a reference only to the Gaboyim, only to the people who were collecting everything. They were commanded to go and take from Bnei Yisrael the copper, the silver, the gold, the wool, and then bring it, and we will build the Mishkan. So it wasn't a command to Bnei Yisrael, it was a command to the Gaboyim, to the collectors, that they would go around and then take. Those are the three understandings of how to understand the word Vayichuli. However, there's a very interesting midrash which says that no, really all Bnei Yisrael was commanded Vayichuli. And the reason why it's Vayichu, take, and not give, is because Hashem was commanding that everybody's friend would take from someone else and bring that to the Gavai, to the Gavais, in order to prepare the Mishkan. So he was commanding a friend to go ahead and take from them. So the question is, what's the need for that? Why can't I just give myself? Why does Saul have to take from me to give to them? That's the question. What was the need that someone else has to do it for me? So you can say a very simple answer. That very often a person will do something because they know they're going to get a thank you for it. Right? They know if I do something for someone, they're going to be very appreciative of it. What the Torah is possibly emphasizing is by having someone else collect for me and give to the Gabbai. The Gabbai doesn't know, right? If Saul takes from me and gives to the Gabbai, the Gabbai's not going to know where Saul got it from. Could have got it from me, could have got it from Maddie, could have got it from somebody else. But by the fact that the Gabbai doesn't know, the Gabbai can't then go ahead and say thank you to me because he doesn't know that it was from me. So meaning that the Gabbai is going to be taking it without the, meaning totally for the right purpose. He's not doing it to expect a thank you. He's not doing it to expect any credit. And this is an important lesson because we often do things for the credit, for the street cred, or to make ourselves look good. And what the Torah is reminding us perhaps is that, think about the consequences before you do something. Realize that you're doing it because for whatever reason you're doing it, and not because what your friend's going to think or what your friend wants you to do. You're doing it because for the right reasons. And I also want to just tie this in to the one another Kalim, the next Kalim after the Aaron is what in the Torah?
Shulchan.
Shulchan, correct. The Shulchan. And the Shulchan is very interesting because the Gemara of Chagiga says that when the Beis Hamikdash stood, so the way that a Jew got kapara, he got atonement, was via the karbanos that he brought. But now there's no Beis Hamikdash. How do we achieve kapara? Through our shulchan. Through our tables. Really? Oh my gosh. I gotta talk to him.
The shittim?
Okay, but not everyone was in there. No, not the shittim.
Not the chesed.
Okay, the chesed. Okay. Not everyone was there. You were there? Okay, good.
Listen. It's good for time.
I don't know if I can say it as good as he did.
I don't know.
It's probably better.
So again, the Gemara says that when the Beis Hamikdash was stood, when we brought Karbanos, that's how we achieved Kapara. But now that the Beis Hamikdash, how do we achieve Kapara? The Gemara says, the Shulchan Shal Adam gives them Kapara. The tables. So what does that mean? What does the table get Kapara? So there's a Gemara in Brachos, in the ninth parak, which says, as follows. It says, someone who is Ma'arich Al Shulchanam, literally means extends the table. So the reward is Ma'arich and Yama Vushnosav. Hashem gives him essentially long days, long years, long life. And Rashi explains, what does it mean to extend the table? It means to make it longer so you can accrue more guests. You can invite more less fortunate or Aniyim into your homes. That's what the Gemara says. And what we see from here is that it's not so much the table, literally, that offers the kapara, but the fact that you're able, through your table, to do a big act of chesed. Because the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, Galal Gima, great is giving guests food and drink, because it's marchikim es hakarovim, it pushes away those who are close, umakreves es harachokim, and brings close those who are far. So what does it mean, it pushes away those who are close? So Rashi points out, refers to Amon and Moab. Because you'll see in Sefer Bamidbar, Amon and Moab are the two people who originally were from us. Right? They're descendants of Lot. They were the children of Lot. When Lot slept with his daughters, so they named their sons Amon and Moab. Moab from the word Me'ah, from my father. Menisha. The daughter named Me'ah because Moab, because she ultimately, the child was from her father, Lot. Now, Amon and Moab, who originally are related to us, when we were traveling through the desert, we came through their lands and we said, yo, can we just like stop here? Like, do you mind if we just come through? And they said, no, you can't come through. We're not going to give you food and drink. We're not going to let you sleep here. So those people are close to us, literally our relatives, they're marchikim, legima. Legima makes them marchikim, meaning the whole notion of giving to your guests pushes them away because they didn't do it. But for us, when we invite guests, when we invite people to our tables one day, hopefully, or even now our families do it, and you see your Rebbeim do it here, it's an unbelievable thing because it brings people who are close, those people who maybe never experienced Shabbos before, who didn't experience Shabbos the right way before, they can suddenly see what Shabbos is like on a Shabbos. Or even when it's not Shabbos, there's something to be said about bringing someone to your table, giving them to drink, giving them a sense of respect, talking to them, the table can go a long way. And the Rebbeim of Bachia points out that there was a minhag in Tzarfas. What's Tzarfas? What? Good. France. There's a minhag in France that when certain people passed away, they would take the wood of their dining room tables.
Oh yeah.
And use it to make a coffin.
I've heard this before.
Was it Rav Dani?
Yeah, it was.
I guess. Yeah.
And the reason why they did that was to show that you can't, you can't take anything with you. Nothing in this world, no money that you accrue, doesn't matter how big your house is or how nice your car is, you're not taking it with you. Right? They say, oh, the famous line, death shrouds don't have pockets, which means that the clothes that they garb you in, but when they put you in the ground, there are no pockets in them. You can't fill them with anything. You can't fill them with anything that you've physically accrued in this world. The only thing you can take with you to the next world, Torah, Mitzvah, Semaisim, Tovim. And what better way to show this by burying them with a table that they did tremendous chesed with? That showed to everybody, it demonstrated that really a person only brings them to the next world, the Torah, Mitzvah, Semaisim, Tovim. The chesed they did via their table, that's what surrounds them as they go into the next world. And I just want to finish with something that Ethan pointed out, and it's something very true. I found it to be very true in life, and hopefully you guys have experienced it also, and will experience it as you, you know, grow on and grow up and mature and live your lives. And that is Vayichu Litruma. Very simple pshat. I think it's the most beautiful pshat. Take from me truma. Right? We often think that when we take of ourselves and give to someone else, it's a loss for us. We're losing. We had something and now gave it away. And it's true in a certain sense, maybe in a physical sense, right? If I have, on a very simple level, if I have a box of chocolates and I walk into a room with you guys and you all say, can I have some? So I give you everyone out and I have none for myself. So I've technically lost. That's what the taking is. You've now taken. However, what we find that's much more, on a much more deeper level, we find in life that it's often the giver who often becomes the taker. I'm sorry, the giver, yeah, often becomes the taker. And it's not just that you are the takers when you take those chocolates, right? I've given to you, but I've also, how have I then taken for myself? How does the giving become the taker? Because that act of chesed I have forever. And the knowing that you guys are happy that you got to eat that chocolate, that gives me a sense of gratitude. I've taken the gratitude. Okay, I've given you the physical chocolate, but the gratitude that I've taken, that's something that'll last for me for weeks and months. And whenever you do a chesed for someone, right, I had a discussion with Ethan and Shelby about this, that is there really such a thing as doing the selfless act? Right? Because, well, here's why. Here's the argument Ethan put up. Is that when you do something for someone that you know they're going to like, when you buy flowers for your mother or for your wife one day, so you're doing it that, right, you're totally giving of yourself to do it, right? Men don't like flowers. I don't even know why women like flowers, to be honest. I don't know. They, like, die in a week, and I don't know, they're pretty, I guess, but, like, it makes such a big deal out of it. Is you know how happy she's going to be when she gets it. So that's ultimately a sense of selfishness, because you know how you're going to feel.
Yeah, but the amount, like, your mother's going to feel so much more happy than you are. So
it doesn't matter, but the fact that you're doing it because you know that you're going to feel happy, that your mother's happy, shows that it's not completely selfless.
It's not completely selfless. Interesting idea. But that's also an important thing. You know, when I was in, for a year, when I was in college, so I spent 1 weekend a month at a Hascom. As Hascom is where people go to Hask in the summer, spend their year. And there's like 9 mentally handicapped people in a house. And you go there, you help them get dressed, and you help them go to shul, and you feed them. And at the beginning, it seems like a little bit of hard work. You gotta help them shower, and it was a geriatric home, and everyone's over the age of like 60. And at first, you feel like you're totally giving of yourself, and it's not really, you know, you get nothing back. But after a while, you see that they return that love to you, and you develop a relationship by doing everything for them. And there's a tremendous sense of pleasure and gratitude in doing that. And that can be from a very simple thing, a very simple act of chesed, or it can be something doing very great. We find that it's very true in life. That's why I always try, you know, if I have something, just give it away. Because I think I said it in Eichshir once before, that which you want to keep forever, give away. Because ultimately, you're not going to keep anything forever. Ultimately, anything physical you have in this world, you're not going to have in the end of the day. So what better way to give it away? Because when you give it away, that person will remember you forever. That act of chesed you'll have forever. You'll bring it to the next world. And I think it's a hard concept, but if we can internalize it, and we can live our lives thinking about that, we often will find that we, not only as the giver, we also become the taker ourselves. Okay, shkoyach guys. Wish you guys a great Shabbos. And...